I think you'll agree with me, because we all read bits of Ethics of the Fathers, not the whole of it, that it is a gem. Indeed, it's a great gem of rabbinic literature. It is the quintessential work on rabbinic ideology. And one may wonder, what's it doing in the Mishnah?
Okay.
What's it there for? Because the Mishnah is a law code. The Mishnah deals with civil law, criminal law, with the regulations of festivals, of Shabbat, of Shechita, you name it. So in the middle of all that, I've got Pirkei Avot. What's it doing there? And indeed, it may be there for that very purpose, to remind us that the duties of Judaism are not just criminal, civil law, and Shechita and Pesach, that we have the duties of Midot, of personal conduct, of leading an upright life, and that's what Pirkei Avot is all about. Indeed, I wish it could be translated into all languages and distributed among humanity, and maybe the world might be a better place for it. But for me, as a student of history, the first chapter of Pirkei Avot plays a very special role, and that's what I want to demonstrate. We know that the most important period for the development of rabbinic Judaism was the Second Temple period. But that's when it was all happening. In the middle of the 5th century, our friend Ezra returns. We dealt with this. And what does Ezra do? He establishes the public reading, teaching of the law. He establishes the administration of justice based on the Torah. We'll look at this again shortly. And so he sets in motion the whole process of interpreting the law. He'll establish the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah to carry on his work. They will promote the synagogue. This is their baby that they will promote as a place for learning, as a place for prayer. They will develop prayers for the ordinary people to use. And most importantly, the Second Temple period witnesses the emergence of an all-important figure, the lay teacher. What do I mean by the lay teacher? Very difficult to explain to a non-Jew today that a rabbi is not a priest. A priest. He's not a priest. They use this lovely word clergy, which I don't like, but a rabbi is not a priest.
Some Jews don't understand that either.
No, I don't. Because they don't. Because a Kohen is a Torah institution, the rabbi is not. He is a figure, a lay teacher, who emerged in the Second Temple period. He's known by different names: Sofrim, the scribes; Perushim, the Pharisees; and ultimately, the rabbis, the term which we use to this day. That's a product of the Second Temple period. So the Second Temple period provided us with the life raft for the survival of Judaism. The Torah, the synagogue, and the rabbinic teacher. So the Second Temple period is of enormous importance, but we don't know very much about what was going on. We know it was happening, but how, what, why and when, very limited. You know, it's only from about the first century onwards we get an explosion of information. Prior to that, the further back you go, the less we know. You know, it's that old adage that a specialist is somebody who learns more and more about less and less, he knows everything about nothing. And, you know, this is the process. As you go back further and further, you've got less and less to deal with. But one of the sources that does give us an insight into that vital period is the first chapter of Pirkei Avot. Now, though I intend to spend some time with you, some considerable time, considering the ethical, moral teachings of Pirkei Avot, I want to begin with a historical perspective. And we begin at the very beginning. The very first Mishnah, you can see it there, the column on the right-hand side. Moshe kibel Torah miSinai. Moses received the Torah from Sinai. Umasara. Now, normally translating, he handed it over. Not a good translation, because the Hebrew word masar doesn't mean to hand over. It means to pass on a tradition. The Hebrew word for tradition is masoret. It means to pass on a tradition. What tradition? Moses received not one Torah at Sinai, but two. He received a written law and an oral law. the oral code which enables us to understand and apply the written law. Without it, I can't practice the Torah. The Torah tells me that I should wear tefillin, but it doesn't tell me what they should be. That I rely upon the oral law. And Moses received these two Torah, these two laws from God, and he hands them over, he passes this tradition on to Joshua. And Yehoshua Liskenim, Joshua transmits it to the elders. The Kenim Linaviim, the elders to the prophets. Unaviim Masaruha Le Anshe Knesset Hagadolah. And he handed them over. The prophets handed them over to the men of the great assembly. That's how I'll translate it. Translate it as the great synagogue. That is not a good term. Great assembly. Knesset is a meeting, an assembly. The Knesset is the parliament. But I have a problem with this. Two problems. What's the point of this? You know, you start this beautiful gem of a Mishnah with this. What are you trying to tell me? I know Moses received the Torah. I know he handed it over to Joshua. I know you've got the prophets, and I know you've got all these other people involved. What are you trying to tell me? And my second question is, there is a glaring omission in this list. Glaring omission. According to the Torah and the Book of Devarim, who is supposed to be the authoritative teachers of the law?
I suppose you're going to say the Kohanim.
Absolutely. It says it.
And they're not mentioned here.
You've left them out. Accidental or intentional?
Intentional.
Well, we're going to assume it's intentional. They're not here. And this, of course, takes me back again. Then what is the purpose of this list? Well, you will know from past sessions, and I'm going to return to this, that there will become a moment in the period of the Second Temple when you're going to have a clash between the Kohanim, the priests, and the lay teachers, the Pharisees. Call them what you will, the lay teachers. And the priests will say to the lay teachers, who are you? Who are you to claim the right to interpret the law? You talk about this oral law you've received from Moses on Sinai. The Torah empowers us to be the teachers of the law. So who are you? What is your authority? We can appoint to the text in Devarim which says, priests, al-pi ha-Torah she-yoruha, they will instruct you. Where are you coming from? And they answered, we derive our authority directly from God to Moses, from Moses to Joshua, from Joshua to the elders to the prophets, and the prophets to the men of the great assembly, from generation to generation. They were ordained. Moses put his head upon Joshua and gave him smicha, he ordained him. And Joshua did this to the elders, and the elders did this to the prophets. And so we can stand here and say we have a license directly from Sinai. And here it is. This opening Mishnah is the credentials.
But who wrote
of the
this?
The lay teacher. This is written by, of course, by a rabbi. By
so
a
the
lady.
One who wrote it is the fellow who says he's got the authority.
That's it. He's putting this down to say, this is our authority. You challenge us? Here's my answer.
If I were a Kohen...
You wouldn't like it. You
no,
wouldn't
not
accept
not.
It. No, of course not. And they didn't like it. And they didn't want to accept it. And they tried to rebuff the oral law. And this struggle went on for some considerable time. Eventually the Pharisees win out because the Kohanim were too incapable of interpreting the law anyway. No, this was a reality. We'll come back to that.
So in a way it's like the first commandment.
Pardon?
In a way it's like the first commandment, establishing the credentials.
Yeah, this is.
Of who is...
Who are our rabbinic teachers and what is their authority? And the answer is divinely ordained.
But where...
where is the authority for including the oral law?
Well,
it is not mentioned.
The point is, the rabbis will tell you it is implicit.
By who?
In the Torah itself.
Where?
Where? I gave one example, Samuel, if you weren't here. The Torah says, doesn't matter. The Torah says, very simply, you have to wear tefillin. How do you know it's supposed to be a black box? How do you know it's supposed to be a black box? Not a voice recorder, but a black box. How do you know it's supposed to contain the four passages that are in there? How do you know that you're supposed to put it on your forehead and not between your eyes? And that you don't put them on your hand, you put them on your arm? I can go on and on. How do you know you're supposed to slaughter an animal by cutting its throat? You bang it on the head. So you have a whole series of commandments given in the Torah that are not explicit. And therefore it needed an oral tradition to elucidate what you're supposed to do.
Yes, but it is explicit that you will wear tefillin.
Yeah, but it doesn't say what they are. I mean, if you look in the Torah, it says, "Kusharatam le'otal yadecha," bind them for a sign of what? Does it say, bind a black box with four parchments in it? See my point, Stanley? The essential command is there. The details are missing. Where do I get those details from? And the rabbis answer, the oral law. You have now, we are counting the Omer. Yeah? When are you supposed to start counting the Omer? The Torah says, in Mimocharat HaShabbat, on the day following the Sabbath. What Sabbath? The Sadducees would say, that means Shabbat Chol HaMoed. So if Pesach occurs, first day Pesach occurs on a Shabbat, all well and good. But if not, if it occurs as it did this week on a Tuesday, then you've got to wait till Shabbat, and that's when you start counting the Omer. So when will Shavuot be? Well, it depends. It won't be fixed, will it? You'll have a floating Shavuot. And the sad Pharisees said, no, on the basis of oral law, Shabbat here means the festival of Pesach itself. And therefore the counting of the Omer begins at a fixed date every year and for every generation for all time, and Shavuot is going to be on the 6th of Sivan. There's your oral law.
So we assume that the oral law has been passed in the exact
order. That Moses received both a written law and an oral commentary. And this he transmitted to future generations. And the medium for their transmission of these guys, principally the lay teachers. Now, this clash between
I find that very difficult to believe, that Moses stood on the mountain and he received six books of the Mishnah, burst his head.
He didn't receive six books of the Mishnah. Oh, Stanley, you are dealing with the impossible.
Impossible, yes. For you and me.
You are dealing with the impossible. Don't forget, this man was receiving it from the ultimate source. Is there anything that God cannot do?
No, but there's a lot that Moses can't do.
Ah, but God can implant into his mind, and if you think it's impossible, then I can assure you, and I assure you very, very ably, that you'll find a young lad in Manchester who has learnt virtually the whole of the Mishnah off by heart.
Yes, but not in one day.
Yeah, 40 days. You'd be amazed what you can do in 40 days. Why not? If you're bright enough. And don't forget, it isn't that Moses is learning, it is God indoctrinating. There is a subtle difference. Who is loading Moses' hard drive? I can't convince you, but this is the received tradition. Moses received the two Torot, and he has passed it on from generation to generation. And you have, as I say, this clash between the priests and the lay teachers. And that may be the reason why, in this chain of tradition, who is noticeably left out? The priest.
But wouldn't it have been the natural course of passing on to.
Yes.
To
include the priest.
To do it first to the priests, yeah, and then perhaps allow them to give it to the lay
well,
teachers.
Well, maybe there's going to be another reason why I want to keep the priests out of the picture. Okay. But you'll have to wait. Won't reach it this evening. Okay. But there's going to be another historical reason why I'm going to disassociate myself from a corrupt priesthood. Okay? Don't want to give away too much of the game, otherwise you won't come back again.
He's very interesting because there used to be somebody sitting next to me in synagogue called Jimmy Sequeira. And he says, if you think I'm going to be blessed by this lot, I'm walking out. And he used to walk out.
Oh, there he's wrong. There he's wrong. You see, Rambam would tell you that even if a priest does not keep Shabbat, it's his mitzvah to bless the people. It's his mitzvah to bless the people. Rambam states a very simple principle that affects all of us. He says, Ein omrin l'rasha. You don't say to a sinner, Hosef Resha, increase your wickedness, for him and Amin a mitzvot, and don't do any of the mitzvot. Even if he's a wicked guy, he wants to perform one mitzvah, encourage him to do it. Don't push him away. Hmm. Fair enough?
Yeah.
That is the nature of Judaism. I know there are those who may not agree, and they will separate themselves out, but we are a highly divisive people. In case you hadn't noticed it. Yeah, whose matzahs did you eat? What we read next, in fact, is passage 3. Because we've established what the purpose of this...
Can I just ask...
Yeah, please.
What is the left-hand column?
I put the left-hand column. I didn't want to confuse you, but if you want to look at it, I'll let you.
It's only the last three lines which are different.
No, there's more than that. You see, if you look carefully...
The prophets as well.
Yeah, but look,
it's the judges.
You've got the judges are included
there.
And that's very important, because the judges are mentioned in the Torah as legitimate interpreters of the law. And what were the judges? Were they priests or were they laymen?
Surely laymen.
They were laymen. And so this guy, the left-hand column represents an older version of Avot. Uh-huh. I don't want to confuse you with it at this stage. We'll come back to it. But I'll put it under your nose so you can see it. What did the men of the Great Assembly say? Passage 3. Anshei Knesset Gedolah. Heim Amru. Shlosha Devarim. They said three things. Hevu Matunim Badin. I'll translate it as it's normally translated. Be deliberate in judgment. The verb Lahamtin means to wait. Yeah? So, take your time.
Passage 3. Be cautious.
Be cautious. Take your time. Be deliberate. But the verb means, Lahamtin actually means to wait. Modern Hebrew, Lahamtin means to wait.
Uh-huh.
Be deliberate, be cautious in judgment. Hamidu Talmidim Harbe, establish many scholars, Ba'asusiag the Torah, and create a buffer zone around the Torah. The most obvious example of a buffer zone around the Torah is that Shabbat begins at nightfall, but we bring it in an hour earlier so that people should not infringe the Shabbat. So if somebody was sitting there for another 10 minutes stitching his coat, it was suddenly, oh, Shabbat, and he will stop. But if he didn't bring in that extra hour, he would be profaning the Shabbat. That's a buffer zone, or a siyag, a fence. I'm going to ask you a question. You've seen these words before. Have you ever heard a rabbi discuss them? Because I don't know if they do it in the Sephardim. See, because we do it in the Ashkenazi synagogue from Pesach to Rosh Hashanah, then Shiurim, the Shabbat afternoon Shiur on Avot, is a regular feature.
Well, see? We do have a stretch where we do it.
Okay, good.
But I think it's before Shavuot. Or
yes, you do between Pesach and Shavuot.
That's right.
So what does it mean? Who's who are these guys talking to when they say, be deliberate in judgment, set up many scholars? Are they talking to us? I doubt it. Why? See, judgment here doesn't mean before you buy a new car, read the manual. Din means the legal process. A bet din. So be deliberate in applying the legal process. That doesn't apply to you and me. That's for the Dayanim. Hamidu Talmidim Arve set up many scholars. That's not for you and me. We don't train scholars. That is for the leaders and teachers to do. V'asu siyag l'Torah, make a fence round the law. We don't do that. That's for the rabbis to decide. So this entire statement has nothing to do directly with the ordinary folk like us. This is not a piece of advice given to you and me.
But who are Anshei Knesset HaGdolah?
Who are they? Exactly. Who are they exactly? Now we have to start filling in, because now I've asked the question, I've got to fill in. Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, we know, were established by Ezra. No. Much more comprehensive.
Yeah.
So
just
much more learned.
No.
These were the leaders of the people. It was a body made up of priests and non-priests, priests and laymen, who performed this supreme council to govern, to ensure the development of Judaism. They were established by Ezra in the middle of the 5th century BCE. That we know. He is the man who founded it.
How many were there?
Don't know, and don't know their names. One of the most disturbing problems, as we shall see about Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, is that they work in almost total anonymity.
Mm-hmm.
We know they're there, we know they're busy, but they work in anonymity. They existed. Their purpose, they were the governing body of the Jewish people.
But who would then gather them to become this body?
No, it was Ezra who did so.
Oh, I see.
Ezra is the convener.
Right, okay.
And why did he convene them? Because Ezra was engaged in something. Ezra was engaged. Remember what Ezra had to do? He is the most important person after Moses in Jewish history. I don't say that lightly, because Ezra was living in Persia. He was a high-ranking official in the court of the Persian emperor after Xerxes, Artaxerxes, but he was a profound religious and learned Jew, educated in Babylon.
Do we know the date?
Yes, 440 is when he comes back to the land of Israel.
Buried in Basra.
Yeah, and therefore he belongs to the middle of the 5th century. And he comes before his imperial master. And he says, I have received reports, disturbing reports, regarding my brethren in the land of Israel. That they are religiously bankrupt, that the temple service has now been desecrated. Give me leave to return to reorganize the life, the religious life, of my brethren. And Artaxerxes says, yes, but come back.
Born in Persia?
Born in Persia. He is a high-ranking official, high-ranking civil servant. And Artaxerxes issues him with a firman, with a decree that he carries with him back to the land of Israel, in case anybody wants to challenge his authority. Do you recognize the seal? He even gave him a platoon of soldiers to take with him. And we do have that original document. It's recorded in the book of Nehemiah. It's the book of Ezra, rather. We have it in its original language, Aramaic, because that was the official language of the Persian Empire. And I'm only interested in one verse. And you can see that in passage 2. It's in Aramaic, where the emperor says, "Ve'ant Ezra." Now you, Ezra, kechokhmat elahach diyadach, in accordance with the wisdom of your God, which I know you possess, meni shoftin v'dayanim, you are to appoint judges and assessors. Dilehevon danin lechol ama. To administer justice to all the people, Diba'avar Nahara, living beyond the river Euphrates, namely l'chol yadei datei elahach, all those who recognize the laws of your God. You are now going back to appoint judges who will administer that law to the Jewish people. Not my law.
Your law.
Your law. The law of the Torah.
Is there anything in the Persian archives about it?
No.
Nothing.
No. But we do know that, for example, Cyrus showed this same broad general spirit, generous spirit. In fact, he licensed them to go back and build a temple and tell them to take your gold utensils back with you. And this is historical.
And how, date-wise, with Esther, how does this...
Don't know, since I'm not sure of the precise date of Esther. They want to say that he was the son of Esther and Ahasuerus. But, okay.
Yeah.
But look what else he says. V'dilai yada tehodun. And as for those who do not know your law, teach them. So Ezra was coming back with a twofold mandate. And what was that mandate? Establish the law of Moses as the basis of Jewish society beyond the Euphrates. Judge the people according to that law. Establish that law code as the functioning law code of your people. And teach them their law. That's a tremendous thing. And I... Yeah.
Was the temple...
Yes, the temple was there and desecrated. What was going on in the temple at that time, you wouldn't want to know. Mm-hmm. You know, it had to be cleaned up. You had non-Jews living there.
So his motive for doing all of this was to organize the people? So
that whose motive?
The
king or Ezra?
The king.
Oh, that's the $64,000 question. What's the king up to?
Hmm.
I mean, I can understand what Ezra's up to. Hmm. You know, he's yearning to do something. And he is a first-class organizer. Don't make any mistakes about it.
Is it true that he made them divorce all their wives?
He made them put away their non-Jewish wives. What he does is nobody's business. He is, of course. You want to argue with me? Whose seal? You're not picking on me. You're picking on the boss.
But how come he was so cognizant?
Yeah.
With, I mean, was there such a
big king.
Jewish community that the emperor should know so much.
Well, there was a fair number of Jews living in both the Babylonian and Persian empires, but there's another factor here. When you rule a vast empire, and it was the biggest one in the ancient world, how do you keep them happy? If I start doing what the Romans did, go around imposing my law on them, they're going to revolt. There is an advantage in allowing local people to live by their own laws as long as they do not disobey mine. Mm.
Mm-hmm.
A wise ruler does this, and the Persian rulers had wisdom. Well, not all of them, but you can see this guy has. And he may have had an additional reason as well. I think I told you this before. I merely remind you that in the middle of the 5th century BCE, a new power was arising in the Mediterranean that would one day challenge and destroy the Persian Empire, the Greeks. And the Persian emperor has his eye on that danger. They're out there. But of course, which of his territories is closest to Greek influence? Which is his border territory?
Israel.
It's on the Mediterranean, isn't it? So he may have had good political reasons for saying to the Jews, I allow you to live by your own laws and remain loyal to me.
Mm. Makes sense.
Does make sense, makes doesn't sense. It? So what are the two things that Ezra is empowered to do? Establish the Torah as the law of the land and to teach the people. So now let's have another look at what the men of the great assembly said. Hevu matunim badin. In applying the judicial process, be most careful, because every decision you make is going to last for all time. What are they doing? They're establishing the law. Hamidu talmidim arbei, raise up many scholars. For what purpose? To act as judges and teachers. That's the role of a rabbi to this day. He is both teacher and judge. It doesn't always fulfill both functions. But that is his role, that he should teach and act as an assessor. And this is what the men of the Great Assembly are stating. This is their mission statement. You know what a mission statement is? Mission statement, what are we all about? I'll tell you what we're all about. Establishing the law and teaching the people. And that's precisely what Ezra was told to do. And so, 200 years after Ezra, they're still carrying out his policy. Does that make sense? Have I confused you, or are you with me? Good. That's looking at it historically. This is the historical significance. But by the by, Ezra did more than just what the Bible tells us. The rabbis have some important traditions regarding Ezra, and you'll see those in passage 4. Learn a little about the great man. Ezra Hitkin de Yisrael. Ezra instituted for the Jewish people Shihu Korim b'Torah, that they should read the Torah not only on Shabbat, but b'Sheni, b'Chamishi, on Mondays and Thursdays, u'b'Shabbat b'Mincha, and on Shabbat afternoon. Why would he do this? Because this is part of his education program. Teach them. But why on Mondays and Thursdays? What's the matter with Tuesdays and Wednesdays? How about Friday? What about Sunday?
Market day.
Market days. Remember that your population in the land of Israel was largely an agricultural one, not living in cities, but living in the countryside, which means they would not have had access to teachers or to synagogues. However, twice a week they would have to come into their local towns because they had a business commitment. I have to bring in the produce on Thursday for Shabbat, and I must bring in the produce on Monday to replenish. So I'm coming into town. Right, says Ezra. I've got you in town, I'll sit and learn. Then I'll educate you. And so we have it on Mondays and Thursdays. Make sense?
Yeah.
He was no fool, I told you. Alan Sugar would have employed him any day. Who hit him? Yeah, well, we're not finished yet. We're not finished yet. Who hit him to Bilal of Ale Kiryan? And he also ruled, he instituted that anybody who came accidentally unclean should first of all go to mikveh before he studies Torah, before he reads the Torah. You are studying the sacred word of God, you'll do so in a state of purity. You're going to take this seriously. Who hitkin shiyahu batei dinin yoshvim ba'arayot b'sheni v'chamishi. He also instituted that the courts should sit in cities on Mondays and Thursdays. What's he doing here? He's promoting the law as the basis of society. And why on Mondays and Thursdays? You guessed it.
Because they're there.
They're coming in. So if this guy comes in and says, I wanted to buy a horse and he sold me a donkey, then he can take the other guy before the judges and let them sort it out.
Now these are very busy days.
They were extremely busy. Mondays and Thursdays were busy days.
Learning the Torah.
You have to first of all attend at the synagogue to hear the Torah. You would conduct your business. You could go before the courts to sort out any disputes. You were tired by the time you got home.
A couple of sacrifices.
And attended the thing. Certainly, for those who are in a state of purity, to participate, maybe to bring a sacrifice. You know, you're out there in the countryside and you made a promise to God, I want to bring a thanks offering for what you've done for me. A todah. So you bring it.
And the sacrifices mostly needed to be eaten, not just...
Oh, sure. Shared between you and God. Yeah. You know, actually, it was shared between what went on the altar, what the priest ate, what the ordinary people took home for sandwiches. Well, it's a convenient form. If I put it that way, you'll remember it.
Well, Doctor, our readings have been what they are today. In other words, passages from the following Shabbat.
No, it would have been very different. There were no fixed readings. No fixed readings. In fact, as late as the period of the Mishnah and the Talmud, you could go in the land of Israel, that is. Babylon established fixed readings by the Talmudic period. But in the land of Israel, two synagogues in the same city were not reading the same parashah on a Shabbat morning. That's an interesting proposition, but it's true. Clearly established in our text.
So when did the tradition of reading it in 1 year rather than
that's,
3 years?
That was a Babylonian institution.
And 3 years.
The 3 years was never really only 3 years.
Oh.
In the land of Israel, it might have taken 3 years, 3.5 years.
Okay.
Because since there was no fixed cycle, it was as long as a piece of string.
Mm-hmm.
There was no fixed cycle. And why? I don't want to get digress too much, but according to the Mishnah, you had to call up 7 people, and each one had to read 3 verses. So what does that make? 21. Only this week, I had 3 more people in synagogue I wanted to call up, so I called up 10. So how many verses did I read? 30. The synagogue down the road only called up 7 people, so they read 21. So already, I'm 9 verses ahead.
Mm.
Need I elaborate? You've got the point already. No fixed reading.
Mismatched.
So, pardon?
Mismatched.
Yes, oh yeah. Yes. But look what else he did, and some of this is rather interesting. Hu hitkin shiyu harochlim machazrim ba'ayarot. He instituted that the peddlers should go around the cities b'nei kavodan shel benot Yisrael for the honour of the daughters of Israel. Now, what on earth is he talking about?
Collecting money.
No, not collecting money. Selling goods. Selling spices and trinkets so that they could make themselves beautiful for their husbands. Oh, he's a practical
toiletries.
Yes. Call it what you
will. Oh, yeah. Perfume.
And he also insisted. He also insisted they should wash their garments on Thursday, out of honor for the Shabbat, that they should wear clean clothes for their husbands. Husbands should wear clean clothes for their wives. Who hitkin she, who ofin pat ba'arwe Shabbatot, and he also instituted they should bake bread on a Friday, not just for their own chalot, shetahei perusam butsuya le'ani, so that there should be bread available for the poor. You are cooking for Shabbat, cook also for the poor. That is essential to Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
We call it Gemilut Chasadim, acts of unselfish love. Bear that word in mind. Moreover, we're told, Hu Hitkin, he instituted, Shihu Ochlin Shumbele Le Shabbatot, that you should eat garlic on Friday evenings, Shu Machnis, Tava, because it arouses love, umotzi tava, and promotes desire. Pass the salami. They believed it, and Friday evening
maybe
was
the garlic was
exactly
from today's garlic.
Oh dear!
I would have thought it would have kept the vampires away. But there we are. The truth is that Friday evening was the optimal evening for marital
mm-hmm.
relationship,
right?
And therefore, you make yourself desirable. Yeah, that helped. Hu hitkin. He also instituted shehiyu hanashim medabrot zoim zo bebeit hakiseh, that the women in the toilet should speak to one another. That's an odd one, isn't it?
What was that?
That women in the toilet should speak to one, because you know they had cubicles, or there'd be might have half a dozen women in there. Keep on talking, girls. Why?
So that the men know they're there.
Now, the men may know they're there, but perhaps, it was to ensure that no man secreted himself in there to take advantage of any of the women. So if Sora in the N cubicle is not speaking, you're entitled to wonder why. You see my point? But this man is trying to establish a society that is pure. That's what he does. That's why he makes them put away their wives. I want a holy society, says Ezra, and you're going to be a holy society, and if you want to argue with me, take a look at the seal.
But could non-Jewish woman not drift into Judaism like Ruth?
Not the case. Not only did they drift in, there are converts. We're going to read about them very shortly. We're going to see that there were converts already in the days of Ezra and earlier.
He's not got anything against them, has he?
Pardon?
He's still got rid of them.
No, not converts. We're talking about mixed marriage, not converts.
Yeah.
Oh, no. Those who became genuine adherents of the law of God were accepted.
Yeah. But if they were mixed marriage and he came along and she said, I'm converting now.
I don't know what he did. But what I do know he did was, if you weren't, you had to send her away.
Oh. It seems very cruel.
Well, if they weren't doing all these things like washing their clothes and talking in the toilet, he'd...
You have to appreciate that Ezra had to come back to a corrupt and bankrupt society.
Which is why he came.
Which is why he came. And therefore, his measures would be apparently even draconian. He was going to sort them out.
And covering.
And the children as well?
What, pardon?
And their children as well?
Well, their children were not Jewish, no.
I suppose those that must have realized that they were bankrupt, and those who wanted to improve did this, and the other.
You can see that a lot of people collaborated with you. You're going to see the collaboration. We're going to unfold all this for you. That's why I say, initially I want to look at history. We'll come back and look at the religious teachings, but I want to show you how modern scholars are looking at this sacred text and getting a lot of information out of it.
Mm-hmm.
This is contained where?
This last passage is to be found in the Jerusalem Talmud.
Okay.
And the last thing, which would be very unpopular today, he instituted, who Hitkin, Shetehei Isha Chogeret Besinar Bein Belefaneha Bein Leachareha, a woman should wear a petticoat which covers up her fore and her aft. No miniskirts to flaunt yourself as you're walking down the road.
He did cover an enormous area.
Because look, he realized it. If women are dressed in a luring way, don't blame the men if they go after them.
But no talk of head covering.
No talk of head covering. It may have been taken for granted because they were covering their heads. Because in a hot climate, in the sun, you cover your head. I mean, you know, nowhere I'll be told in halacha wear trousers, because it's... you're told not to go naked. But you can see the range of activities attributed to this man. Here is a revolutionary. He is a man who's reorganizing his society.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as I said earlier, we still have a little time. The strange thing about the men of the Great Assembly is that they are anonymous. Mm-hmm. They really are secretive about their identity. Until some 210 years or more after Ezra, we're given a name. And you find it in Mishnah Avot. Look at passage 5. Shimona Tzadik Hayam Bishyarei Knesset HaGadolah. Simon the Just was the last of the men of the Great Assembly. And that's so peculiar. You spend 200 years in silence, and when at long last you give me a name, you're winding up your business. You're going into liquidation. What's going on? He was the last. Hu haya Omer, and he used to say, Al shlosha devarim ha'olam omed, the world stands upon three things, al ha-Torah, al ha-Avodah, al gemilut chasadim, upon Torah, upon Avodah, which I could translate in one of two ways, work, because the rabbis had a remarkable work ethic. You're going to see that before I'm finished with you this term. Did they have a work ethic? And acts of unselfish love. But of course, avodah can mean something else. What else could it mean? The temple ritual. That was the avodah, the temple ritual. Only, what does he mean when he uses this word? You see, comes out of nowhere and tells me these are the bases for the Jew. Is it the world? Is it the Jewish world? It's not just the Jewish world. He means the world.
On Kippur, when we say Petichat HaAvodah,
we have the ritual, but why does this affect the non-Jewish world, I'll tell you. Although the Torah was given principally and initially to the Jewish people, it contains a blueprint for the whole of human society. They're called the Sheva Mitzvot, the Bnei Noach. The seven Noachite laws, which God demands, should be the basis of human society. You don't rob, you don't murder, you don't behave immorally. They are for the world, not just for us. And if you don't observe them, then your society will collapse. You'll have what's going on in the Middle East at the moment. Yeah or no? So, it does refer to the whole world. And as for acts of human kindness, that is incumbent upon all human beings. Not just Jews. Unfortunately, we've been on the receiving end of a lack of human kindness. But that's all the more reason why we should be decent to one another. So what does he mean by Avodah? The only way I can answer this is by asking, who is Shimon HaTzadik? You know the name, Simon the Just. I'll tell you who he was. He was the high priest. So who's the high priest when he says Avodah? What's he talking about?
Sacrifice.
Temple service, the ritual. But he's more than just a high priest, my friends. He was the civil governor of the little state of Judea. From the days of the Persians, high priests were given civil authority. They were the religious leaders. He was Kohen Gadol. He's Kohen Gadol, who is also the civil governor. He's ruling that land. And we have a description of how he's building the walls of Jerusalem, a contemporary description of his administering the country. So he's here. And this was the role of the high priest for generations. From the days of the Persians onwards, this was their role. And over and above that, he has the keys to the temple treasury with its vast financial reserves. And if that were not enough, he was the head of what would eventually become known as the Sanhedrin, the Supreme Court. So he is a powerful figure, and his office is a powerful one and extremely attractive to unscrupulous people who might want to take it. Just bear that thought in mind. So I'm looking here at a high priest who is advocating and promoting the worship of the temple as being beneficial for the sake of all mankind.
But that was a tradition, and it had nothing to do with being appointed by the Persian Empire.
What
it was a tradition within those who inhabited Judea.
Yeah.
No, it was nothing to do with being appointed by...
No. The Kohen, the high priesthood, was determined by Jewish tradition.
Yes.
That's it. So, to be a high priest, you had to be the son of a high priest.
Yes, but what I meant is the post of governor.
Post of governor.
Yeah.
What happened was, and you can understand this, that the civil authority, you know, the we'll call them the suzerain, the overlord, would use a local person to act as his viceroy. So who do you take? You will take the most powerful person in the land. And who is the person who exercises the greatest authority? The Kohen Gadol, the high priest.
When Ezra came, his position was set. Must have been a high priest.
There was a high priest, but he wasn't. There was a high priest who was in fact superintending a bankrupt situation. Mm. And Ezra takes over. By the way, Ezra is a Kohen, but he doesn't function as a high priest. Oh, what? Oh, no two ways about it. So, this is a mighty powerful office, and therefore Shimon HaTzadik, who is the last of the men of the great assembly, is saying to his world, these are the bases of Judaism, and it applies to this day.
And for us, Torah. Avodah means prayer.
For us, Avodah means the ritual that has replaced the sacrifices, prayer. Mm-hmm.
The prayers three times a day.
Yeah, prayer. That is our But acts of unselfish love, I needn't elaborate. That is what characterizes Judaism. You don't notice that the Israeli governments are shooting their citizens on the streets. But those regimes that profess the peaceful and humane religion of Islam have no problems with that. So that's what distinguishes us, gemilut chasadim. And that doesn't mean looking after the members of your own royal family, but looking after the poorest person in the street. Okay, can I move you on now to a big question? What's the big question? Why did the men of the Great Assembly come to an end? If it was doing such a fantastic job, and it was doing a fantastic job, why did they wind up their business? Well, to answer that question, being a good Jew, I have to ask another question. Because yeah, we won't answer that question this week. You know, I've got to keep you on tenterhooks. Ezra is a biblical figure. He's mentioned in the Bible. He's got the book of Ezra, the book of Nehemiah, his colleague. Ezra establishes the great assembly, Knesset Gedolah. Okay, so is the Knesset Gedolah mentioned in the Bible? And the answer is no. It isn't. But it may be implied. Ezra is this super organizer. And on the 24th day of the month of Tishri, when he had returned, he called together another supreme convention, a great assembly of the people. He did it on the first day of Rosh Hashanah when he read them the Torah. He's doing it again. Only this time he presents them with a charter. A charter, the text of which is preserved in the book of Nehemiah. It's a charter which has been drawn up and signed by the leaders of the people, the priests, the Levites, and the lay leaders. It's presented to the people, and they, the ordinary folk, pledge their support to it. If you come over the page, back on 6, I'll read it with you. You may find it a little disturbing. Now the rest of the people standing there, picture it, can you see the scene? Leaders on the platform, ordinary people standing in front of them. Hakohanim, the ordinary priests. Halevim, the ordinary Levites. Hasharim, the gatekeepers. Hamashorim, the choristers. Hanatinim, the temple servants. V'chol hanivdal me'ame ha'arotzot el Torat Elohim. And all those who had separated themselves from the pagans and attached themselves to the law of God. What would you call that? A convert. Oh. Right? There's your converts. Neshehem, not only them, but their wives. Benehem, their sons. Benotehem, their daughters. Kol Yodeyamin, Meivin, all those who knew how to explain the Torah. The entire population standing there. What did they do? Machazikim alachehem adirehem. They pledged their support for their brothers, their nobles, their leaders. Uvaim ba'ala uvishvua. And they entered into a curse and an oath. Boy, that's serious. What do you mean a curse and an oath? In Hebrew, when you swear an oath, you say, I swear that if I don't do something, may such and such happen to me. I swear if I do something, may such and such a thing happen to me. So you are inviting a curse to come upon yourself if you don't keep your oath. Got it? And they entered into this most sacred oath to do what? Lalechet b'torat ha'elohim, to walk in the law of God. Asher nitna b'yad Moshe, which had been given by the hand of Moses, Eved Elohim, the servant of God, Lishma, to observe the negative commandments, Velasot, to perform the positive commandments, Eid Kol Mitzvot Adonai Adonainu, all the commandments of the Lord our God, Umishpatav Echukav, his just judgments and his statutes. That really is a pledge, isn't it? But we mention in particular, we will no longer give our daughters to the pagans. We won't take their daughters for our sons. They're signing the pledge, no more intermarriage. Communal purity. And when the pagans, Mavim et Makachot, bring their merchandise into the cities, V'chol Shever, and all their corn, their food, B'yom HaShabbat, on a Sabbath day, Limkor, to sell it to the Jews, and up to now we've been buying it on Shabbat, we did our shopping down at Asda. From now on, Lo Nikach Mehem B'Shabbat, we will no longer purchase from them on Shabbat. He's putting it very, very over Yom Kodesh, no on Yom Tov. V'natash et hashana hashviyit, and we will forego the produce of the seventh year, umasha kol yad, and collecting all debts, we will have now observed the Shemitah year, and we will leave for the poor, and we won't exact our debts. So quite clearly these were issues which disturbed Ezra more than anything else. And he's making them swear. So what are they committing themselves to? Observance of the Torah. Yes? Greed? Mm. Look what comes next. Vehemadnu aleinu. And we impose upon ourselves mitzvot, commandments, latet aleinu shlishita shekel b'shana, to give a further third of a shekel every year, over and above what the Torah requires, le'avodat beit Eloheinu, for the ritual, the temple ritual, the avodah. For what purpose? Lechem ha'marechet, the showbread, minchat ha'tamid, ulat ha'tamid, the daily sacrifices, ha'shabbatot, the Sabbath sacrifices, chodashim, the new moon sacrifices, mo'adim, the festival sacrifices, Kodashim, for the other holy offerings, Lechata'ot, for the sin offerings, Lechaper al Yisrael, to procure atonement for the Jewish people. And we give this money, B'chol Melechet Beit Eloheinu, for all the work required for the house of our God. Now, what are the two things these people have sworn on oath? What are they committing themselves to in that square in Jerusalem, 440 BCE? We will uphold the law, and we will maintain the Avodah. 210 years later, what did Shimon HaTzadik say? The world rests upon three things. Torah, Avodah. He's echoing the charter which we believe marked the foundation of the men of the Great Assembly. Do you see that, my friend? You're looking at how we extract history from our text. Only Shimon HaTzadik saw it necessary to introduce Gemilut Chasadim, acts of unselfish love. And the fact that he emphasizes it suggests to me, I don't know about to you, he saw it as a necessity.
What would be the equivalent of a third of a shekel in those days?
50p.
50p per annum?
Per annum.
Not much.
Not much, but if you've got it from the Jewish people throughout the world, if you manage to collect it, we know that. In fact, according to Rambam, the minimum amount of tzedakah a Jew should give in any year is a third of a shekel.
Third
of a shekel? Yeah. That's the minimum. Yeah. Well, he says, ideally you should give it a fifth or at least a tenth. But if you give, if you give less than a third of a shekel, you haven't fulfilled your mitzvah. Now that may sound crazy, but it's not as crazy as you think. Because God in effect says to us, I'm leaving room for you to show me how much you love me. A third of a shekel is minimal. Now let's see what you're prepared to do. Okay, we'll stop at this point.